Welcome back to Too Much Future, the Fallout show, where we play the Fallout games and we talk about them. We're still talking about Fallout 2. We are near the end of the game. I'm Cameron.
I'm Michael.
Oh, golly. I'm trying to project a tone already. So, you know, so we can just ease into it like a beautiful lake.
Mm-hmm.
Michael, how where are you at? Just normally we say, you know, we give some kind of where you at with the game at the end of the episode. But here at the beginning of the episode, this episode, of course, we're going to Navarro. And we're also covering San Francisco, kind of two major late game locations. Where are you at with the game as of this very minute?
As far as I'm concerned, the game is over.
In the sense of you've completed the game or in the sense of like there's not much left for you?
There's not much left for me. I have had... Fallout 2 has been an interesting experience, and I guess I'll have more to say about this when we finish up and if we do a reflection episode, but the... Fallout 2's highs have been much higher than Fallout 1's, but also that has made the lows much worse, and I have reached a point with this game where I just... Like, I do not care what is happening in the back third. Like, it is... Like, not at all sort of compelling to me.
Yeah, I guess I'm in an interesting spot. Oh, I'm just getting caught up emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
One little tear is rolling down my cheek.
When I think about my relationship with Fallout 2.
I think we'll get to it in the episode where some twists and turns happened here. But yeah, this... I think kind of doubling down on what we said, I think in the last episode, where like the game should just be over when, you know, you shouldn't have to go and like fight the Enclave and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing like, I don't care about the Enclave.
No,
I don't care. And I actually resent in a significant and strong way. I resent the things that are done in this episode in order to make me care about the Enclave.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is, it all feels like someone desperately trying to be like, no, you're supposed to care. There's more game to play. You're supposed to care. And it actually ruins some of the goodwill that Fallout 2 has built up, I think. I think just, you know, a whole chunk of the end of this game is very ill-advised and not for me. But I guess saying that, we went to Navarro.
Mm-hmm.
How'd that happen for you?
So we left off with Hakunin having told us to go, how to get to Navarro. And my immediate fear at this point was that because I've been the one who's been consulting walkthroughs to kind of get a sense for where we should be going and how we should be getting there, I was under the impression that Navarro wasn't going to show up on our map. Did mm-hmm. it show up on your map?
Yeah,
it did. Okay. So, at first, I was very afraid that Navarro wasn't going to show up on my map, even though Hakunin told me how to get there. So, I was not looking forward to that, but lo and behold, it turns out, yeah, it is there, and you can just walk down the coast to get to this location. When you're not dying constantly, because it's surrounded by Enclave patrols who kill me in, like... two or three hits, and they're like, you know, it's just like dudes in power armor. Like it's, you know, late on a level, I understand this, right? Because it's late game. Like these are the big bad enemies, but it also feels like, there has been an issue of maybe this is not your experience. Maybe it is, Cameron, but mm-hmm. the encounters don't feel balanced at all. Like, it feels like I had a very brief moment in the middle of this game where I felt like the combat was working the way it was supposed to, and now it's just a nightmare of, like, overpowered mobs, bullet sponges, and things like that. So I'm just dying constantly trying to get to Navarro. And I get to Navarro, and it's a gas station.
Mm-hmm. Well, can I say yeah. one thing about all these enemies in combat real quick?
Sure.
That is exactly my feeling about it. And actually, I think that this is like a massive problem for the game. And it really makes it feel, you know, we've talked a few times about how this game is kind of on the cusp, right, of the development, big developments in the RPG genre. around both like role-playing kind of stuff too, but like questions about what the player's role in the world is, right? Is this a simulation or is it a story that you're playing along with, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the intent here, right, because partially what you're talking about is that all around Navarro are patrols of Enclave soldiers in full power armor, and in one round of combat, they will annihilate all my people. Like, mm-hmm. they will obliterate them. And there's, like, 7 or 8 most of the time. You know, it's not 2 where I could, like, reasonably have an encounter.
Mm-hmm.
The idea here, right, which you know, very Gygaxian in the murder Mages and Murder Dads parlance here, but the idea is that, of course, this is, Navarro is some sort of military base. Of course, there's going to be patrols around, which is, like, A-okay. But the game gives me exactly one tool for dealing with these encounters other than fighting them, which is like having a very high outdoorsman skill.
Mm-hmm.
Which might have been, that might be fine, right? But it's kind of weird, or it's not kind of weird, it's bad. This is an oversight. That you can create a plurality of different characters in the world. And this is why we talk about Fallout 2, right? That you can talk your way out of anything. You can talk your way through the final boss, all this kind of stuff. You can do that, but you can't lockpick your way out of being attacked 7 times in a row by laser weapons, right? Mm-hmm. You can't speech check your way out of that. You have to take one skill, outdoorsman, to even have a chance of not fighting these things directly in these incredibly pitched battles. And if you're doing that, then that's not like the thing that is, you know, the virtue of this game, which is quote-unquote player freedom, right? Me having to take one skill and then spend a huge chunk of my leveling capability to make that one skill useful, that is the antithesis of player freedom in any kind of like ideological form, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that is just telling me the way I have to play the game to not feel like I'm hitting my hand with a hammer the whole time.
Right.
And so, like, there are ways, this is yet another example, I think, of the way that we talk about the game culturally and the way that the game actually works being very different. But I just want to, so I had the exact same problem over and over and over again. In fact, I probably played for 30 minutes before I got to Navarro.
Yeah.
Saving after every encounter. But anyway, so we get to there. It's a gas station.
Yep. And I'll go ahead and get to it. I die a bunch of times at this gas station in the areas that just surround it. Mm-hmm. Here is the big reveal at the beginning. Twelinor, who is just so frustrated at this point, right? Seeing all of these doomed timelines where she heads out into the desert and dies, and then finally gets to Navarro and dies a couple of times, because you get there and you meet this guy outside the gas station who basically tells you to go along and go to San Francisco, which is another thing that is happening here in the late game, where you're kind of being sent on a lot of runaround quests. But I was so, like, clearly if I go to San Francisco, I might get something, some way that will let me get into this military base without dying. I don't care anymore. Twelinor doesn't have time for this stuff. Everyone in her village is gone. They've been kidnapped. And you know what? Telenor does not like slavery. She does not like slavers, and this seems about the clearest sort of frame of reference she has for what has happened to Arroyo. So I decide that this is the point where Twelinor, pulls kind of, her true tonk card, right? She punches through reality. On my end, out here in the real world, I pull up the F12 SC character editor, Twelinor gets, 999 hit points, 300 action points, 300% small gun skill, 300% outdoorsman skill, and she completes her transformation into Helenor. And she goes to Navarro, and she murders everyone, because this game just needs to stop. I can talk a bit more in a bit more granular detail about how this works out, but I just want to say, like, right up front, I pulled out the character editor. Like, I am done with combat. I do not care about fighting people in this game. I just want to move the pieces in the right direction that I can finish it.
Yeah, because the game becomes, on a mechanical layer at the end, it becomes miserable. And I say that we were talking before a couple days ago. We were talking about how Baldur's Gate and the Baldur's Gate games have really aged really well, and how I don't think that Fallout 2 has really aged very well here, you know, especially this in-game portion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of that has to do with the complexity of combat. You know, what's weird is that Fallout 2, a normal, just average battle, just, you know, dudes in the desert,
mm-hmm.
that is about as complicated as, like, a lich fight in Baldur's Gate 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason for that is that the Baldur's Gate, and D&D, of course, right, because it's Dungeons & Dragons based on 2.5, it has a both wide and deep system of things you can do. So, like, there are all kinds of different attacks and equipment and spells and ways of interacting with the world in combat. And each of those have, like, several gradations of them as well, right? And so, like, you really have to start thinking, you know, people can go back and watch Mages and Murder Dads and see, like, the ways that Danny / Balthazar got through many of the encounters in the game to see, like, how that works as a solo barbarian character. As opposed to Fallout 2, which has none. It is not wide or deep. It's exactly one level deep, and it's only as wide as the number of weapons that are in the game, right? So, like, every time I enter combat in this game, I'm doing the same thing with no additional tactical or strategic, like, thinking as I was at the very beginning of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's nothing additional added to it the whole time. It's unfathomable to me. And normally I'm not the person who's like, I need more stuff to do, because I often find that annoying too. But this is just like bare bones minimum. So that's all to say, I hit a very similar point where I was just like, oh my God, I'm going to have to be wandering all around this universe. However, that did not make me break out the character editor. We'll talk about that later. So, you get here, gas station, there's a guy in a robe. His name is Chris.
Yes.
And Chris wants you to know that he's just a guy running the gas station.
Mm-hmm. Poseidon Oil or whatever.
Oh, I didn't catch that. Yeah. I didn't catch that. That's interesting, because a place we go later is also called Poseidon,
yep.
Right?
Yep. Chris is just a guy hanging out in a purple robe in front of a gas station, letting you know that he's just a guy in a purple robe who runs a gas station. Mm-hmm. Tells you to run along to San Francisco if you want to see anything interesting. And San Francisco is south of here, and we've heard about San Francisco a couple of times. And this is, I think, probably the first time we're given any indication of where it is. So mm-hmm. you can bookmark that for later. But what Helenor did is, after Chris sort of told her off, she went to his, like, little shack behind the gas station. Because she knew there is a path behind the gas station that'll take you directly to the gates of the military base. And if you go here and you make the guards angry, they will instigate combat, and they will destroy you immediately with their laser weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So Helenor goes in. She tries to get into Chris's shack. The door is locked. He tells you not to do that. Helenor turns around, shoots him in the head. He explodes. Also, the other thing that is important,
does a lot of damage at this point.
Yeah, the other thing that is important to know about Helenor is that in addition to all of her stats being boosted, she rolls criticals 100% of the time.
That's great.
Yep. So she goes into his little shack, and there's a trap door in there. And if you take that trap door, you end up underneath the Navarro base. Which, again, I had already, like, gotten here. I knew that you could do this, but then I had ended up in this position where once you are in the base, if anyone sees you, everyone is automatically hostile to you. So then you have to deal with that. Mm-hmm. So, again, this is one of the reasons Helenor comes to be. And then, yeah, I basically went through Navarro and killed everyone who was talking to me or, like, yelling at me or attacking me. And I found out that the people from Arroyo weren't there.
Of course they wouldn't be.
Right. Yeah, because this is...
Your princess is in another castle.
Uh-huh.
Helenor.
How is this for Tungsten?
Well, Tungsten went to the gas station. The guy said there wasn't a military base there, and so Tungsten left.
Okay.
So I didn't do any of this first. I just went to I just went to San Francisco. So we can kind of come. Did you do any of the quests for?
So
like in Navarro.
So like here is what Helenor does in Navarro. She infiltrates it. She shoots just about everyone she sees. She loots every single locker that she can find, hacks every single computer that she can find, looking for information about what is supposed to happen next. And because of this, I get the FOB that'll help us later. We'll talk about that.
Mm-hmm. The forward operating base, of course.
Yes, yes, yes. And then, you know, goes up to the surface of the base, like the ground level. Kills everyone here, steals some vertebrate plans that happen to be in a locker, and gets a new party member, a robot dog named K-9, whose entire gimmick is just, what if RoboCop was a dog?
Well, what if RoboCop was a dog?
He turns out he's not very interestingly written. You could actually do a lot more with that gag than the game seems to do in the end.
Dang.
Yeah,
that's unfortunate. I mean, we know how RoboCop can really liven up a game. You can see the new Mortal Kombat DLC to learn more about that. But so Tungsten just leaves, you know, goes to San Francisco because Chris says, "Hey, don't go in my shack." He says, "Don't do bad stuff to me." And so I say, "All right, go to San Francisco." First screen is San Francisco. You're in Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
Like most of it takes place in Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
Half of it, I guess, takes place in Chinatown. I go in and I see two people in an arena in the middle of the street, like a boxing ring almost, mm-hmm. in the middle of the street fighting. One is named Lo Pan,
mm-hmm.
and one is named The Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that probably, if I could, you know, go back and I could sum up all of the, like, conceptual writing of this game into one statement, it would be, there are two Asian factions. One is commanded by Lo Pan, the villain from Big Trouble in Little China, and one is controlled by the Dragon, an obvious Bruce Lee reference.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Yep.
And they don't like each other.
Mm-hmm. So, this is... San Francisco continues this game's very, very bad handling of race.
Yep.
Did you get any of the lore about San Francisco?
I got a little bit of history from someone who explained to me that San Francisco had been like completely bombed, mm-hmm. after the bombs dropped, and some people who were on a submarine, mm-hmm. showed up, and they came out and they like rebuilt part of San Francisco, and now they live there.
Yes, and so, like, to be specific, the mechanisms here in terms of backstory, mm-hmm. Actually, we should establish, first of all, in case you're, you know, not if the viewer listener is not from America and doesn't know all this stuff, San Francisco has a Chinatown,
mm-hmm.
right? There is a very large Asian American population in San Francisco. This is a thing. We all know this. Mm-hmm. There is a long history of, you know, how Asian immigrants and Asian Americans have lived in and been treated by San Francisco and sort of the, you know, the American state. Mm-hmm. We can set that aside just to point out.
Huge kind of labor explosion at the late end of the 19th century, just for context, right? Building the railroads, mm-hmm. building mines, things like that. So the massive importation of labor from across Asia.
Yeah. So. Yep. That exists, right? That is real-world context. That is a thing. The parts of San Francisco that you see in this game are Chinatown. But the people who live there are not the Chinese Americans who live in the actual Chinatown. Because when the bombs fell, apparently, everyone in San Francisco was obliterated. and a Chinese war submarine, right? A nuclear submarine, because of course the American forces are fighting the Chinese in the war. That is the pretext for the like Fallout series. A Chinese nuclear submarine called the Xihuangti happens to, like, it's like stranded in the ocean and then washes up on the shore of San Francisco, and then all of these Chinese soldiers move into San Francisco's Chinatown and repopulate it and build their own new society that we discover is called the Xi.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just very, very weird.
They have an emperor.
Yes. Right? Like, there's a way that in order to give some sort of lore justification for the deeply, deeply stereotyped representation of Chinese people that we get here, like an actual population of Chinese Americans gets destroyed. And then it's just like, and then we just got like, we got another little like seed of Chinese people who came in and resettled the exact same area by coincidence.
Yeah, the equivalent would be like, you know, like in Wisconsin, they have like, you know, like little Swiss villages mm-hmm. that are like little recreation villages, right? It would be like if we made Fallout and it would be like the little Swiss village was destroyed. Everyone was annihilated. But afterward, there was a blimp full of Swiss people who landed in rural Wisconsin and built their own Swiss village. That's bizarre. That's absolutely bizarre and weird. And brought in all their Swiss values, such as neutrality and cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we can get away with making them more stereotyped is, well, these are actually real Swiss people.
Yeah. And wild. It's, and again, right, like I think, I don't know what the political situation of China is in the Fallout lore, but like, to be clear, these are not CCP people, right? This is not like the Chinese Communist Party. Like, this is straight up like martial arts stereotyped, like from like a Western perspective, big trouble in Little China, like Orientalism. Like, that is what this area is.
Big Trouble in Little China is a more progressive
yes.
piece of work than like by far than this is. Yeah, it's really weird too, and it feels like it. Like, it's kind of hard to know in some ways. Like, it's almost in places where they kind of backed into like really awful stuff. So for example, they have access to technology that's just better than everybody else's.
Right.
And it's like, well, was that intended? Because, you know, this is Fallout, right? And so that's been part of half of these places. Is that stereotyping people? Or is that just, you know, the way that Fallout works? Who knows? They've done so little work to differentiate or to make this readable and accessible and not offensive that it's impossible to know one way or the other. Like, what is being intended to have sort of double meanings here and what isn't?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Eleanor, after clearing out Navarro completely, she shows up, she wanders around Chinatown, she meets, there's a lot more we can say about what happens in Chinatown, because Eleanor has extensive dealings here, but she also drops by the Brotherhood of Steel Bunker. Did you do this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, I don't know if you have to, but I did see it, and I was like, oh yeah, well, that's, gotta get down there and see what they're up to.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I also have power armor by this point. One of the things that I pulled out of the lockers in Navarro is power armor. So the thing that Eleanor was denied in the last game, Twelinor takes as her own.
Yeah, it's actually kind of weird. The game basically forces power armor onto you at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about that when we get to, when I talk about my more extensive Navarro stuff. But so Brotherhood of Steel, you go and talk to them. And the Brotherhood of Steel, like, basically lays out, like, all the mysterious thoughts that we had about the Brother of Steel
yep.
earlier in the game. They just, like, exposition it right out to you. To the point where it's a little bit, like, some of your dialogue options are basically like, all right, tell me the plot of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what's happening. And so they have been, it's actually, this is probably one of the better, like, think pieces of conceptual writing here. And I really wish that I had seen, like, any of it beforehand. Brotherhood of Steel guy tells Tungsten that they have been keeping an eye on the Enclave for a long time. And now, in kind of the Brotherhood of Steel, Keepers of Technology world versus the Enclave, which is still fairly mysterious what they're up to, but they have that similar technology, in the kind of like stable relationship, right, between the two of them, in the sense of they're technologically equal, now the Enclave have access to vertibirds, which means that it's just a helicopter, which means that they can now invade inland and they can move troops very quickly in a way that the Brotherhood of Steel can't. And that's got the Brotherhood of Steel like really freaked out. And so Brotherhood of Steel tells me, hey, you should go to their base in Navarro, which is definitely there, and you should try to get recruited so you could steal the vertibird plans and give them to me so that I will be able to give the Brotherhood of Steel vertibirds so everyone has helicopters. It's like
helicopters,
it's the nuclear
for all.
Helicopter. Radiation for some and helicopters for others. but yeah, that's basically the vibe I get. I never got an answer to why they knew my name the first time I met them, though.
Yeah, no, they, it, so, one of the ways to think about, I guess, how this game feels here at the end, it sort of feels like a different game. It feels like the game that is Fallout 2, in sort of a plot sense, got put on hold for the past however many hours we've been playing. And now suddenly this Brotherhood of Steel guy has to be like, yeah, we're the Brotherhood of Steel. We considered ourselves the technology police of the wasteland. And that is specifically the term he uses, is technology police.
Yeah, I actually laughed when I read the line, because it's just like, it's almost like someone reading out of a design document, right? Brotherhood of Steel - technology police. And someone was just writing, was like, all right, they're the what now? Okay, technology police. Here we go. Put that in the game.
Yeah, so they're goal, I guess, is to watch technological development and basically make sure that certain people don't develop certain types of technology. And now we just get this, like, this entire explanation of the Enclave, who have been hinted at throughout the game. But as I think I said last episode, I have not been given, other than the fact that they exist, have not been given a pressing reason to think that, like, they exist and they, like, are killing people, but lots of people exist and kill people in this world. So in terms of, like, comparing the Enclave to other factions that I've encountered, there's nothing that seems to really set them apart, right, to make them worthy of special attention. But now, as you say, now they have vertibirds, so now they can become expansionist. Mm-hmm. Here's the other thing. Also, every other faction is basically expansionist. The thing that makes the Enclave bad is that they have the means to be more forcefully and aggressively expansionist than anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Which I agree, right, that this is bad in kind of a general sense, but it's interesting to me how the Enclave is literally just every other faction, but more capable. And that's what makes, that's apparently enough to make them evil. Or rather, like, not that I'm saying that Enclave is not bad, because we find out some more stuff about them, but it says something about kind of the imagination behind this game, right? The imagine, mm-hmm. like the scope of how the world is being imagined. And so, like, what makes the Enclave the biggest threat is that they have helicopters. And guess what? Mm-hmm. The Brotherhood of Steel has helicopters now too, because I stole those plans and I handed them immediately over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the game seems to hold, right? And I think that this is really holding to like a very 1990s like idea. That, you know, that we've talked about a few times here, that it's okay as long as it's a war of all against all, but no one should have an advantage over anyone else.
Right.
Like, in any kind of sense, right? Which is why, like, you know, NCR New Reno, or New Reno and, or NCR, gosh, keeping it all in my head is hard. NCR paying New Reno to attack Vault City, to make Vault City want to join NCR, like, that's okay. That's like acceptable geopolitics going on here. And it's because it's just everyone using Tommy guns, right? Like, at the end of the day, it's not a unique form of like violence. But once you get a helicopter, everything's out the window. Okay, yeah, I handed over the plans too when I got back. Did you do the dragon and Lopan's quest?
I did not. I, like, talked with the dragon. He trained me in unarmed, and I was like, this is great, and I could see that there's a quest here, but I just don't want to touch any more of this. Did you do this?
Yeah, I did. Okay. It's actually an interesting kind of quest. I actually really like the dragon training thing, because you can go and talk. So basically, Lopan is evil, and so if you have really negative karma, you train with Lopan. The dragon is good. If you have good karma, you train with the dragon.
BioWare's Jade Empire.
I mean, yeah. I mean, this is the, in fact, you know, the DNA
yes.
of the BioWare RPG, so that makes 100% sense. Dang, Jade Empire, I guess we won't ever get to Jade Empire. Maybe I'll, is it on PC? I might stream that game. Anyway, getting off track.
Yep.
So what happens, you know, you go to the dragon and you say, hey, the dragon, I would like to apprentice underneath you, because I believe Lopan is bad, because he's, you know, the bad guy. And the dragon says, all right, well, you have to train. You have a low skill. And so every day, every 24 hours, you can train with him, and he'll give you 5% more unarmed skill. And I really like that. I wish there was way more of that in this game, where you could, like, go and hang out with people and spend a lot of time doing something, and maybe even like make it cost something, but then that would like pay off in boosting certain skills. I think the game could be a lot more interesting if there were more organic ways of doing that.
Yeah, it's a little Elder Scrolls-y.
It's a little Elder Scrolls-y, right?
Going to the town and finding like the person who would know about alchemy and being like, please teach me alchemy.
Yeah, and I'll pay you money for it or whatever. And that would actually, I think, alleviate some of the issues around like singular build issues in Fallout. Mm-hmm. You know, it would allow you to kind of spread those points out. I would love, and maybe there's someone in it and I just didn't ever find it, right? But someone, for example, to train my outdoorsman skill to allow me to get better at the wasteland. I mean, it's kind of nonsensical, you know, if you really start thinking about it. It's kind of nonsensical for me to be wandering the wasteland constantly and never get better at wandering the wasteland.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just other than intentionally spending skill points. But I feel like there could have been some sort of passive skill point additions. But of course, people would abuse that. And of course, we know that the ultimate sin in a video game is doing something that is in fact abusable by some people. That we can't have that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you gotta have a stable state at the bottom of the skill system. Anyway. Talk to the dragon, you do all this stuff, and you can challenge. Basically, I said, hey, I want to challenge you. And he's like, wait, do you want to challenge me, or do you want to prove your skills? And I said, I want to prove my skills, because I have 100% unarmed skill. I'm maxed out there. I'm good at punching. I know, you know, this is tungsten. I've got all this tunk DNA in me, ready to punch and smash. And so we go into an arena. This is not like the boxing match that I did in New Reno, and it's kind of not like any other fighting in the game so far, in the sense that it's like fully simulated combat. It's not just us swinging back and forth at each other.
Mm-hmm.
You defeat the first person, you defeat the second person, you defeat the third person, you defeat the fourth person. I think there's a fifth even. But here is the problem in it. If you kill anyone, it glitches the game, like, significantly, and like it stops not working. They start attacking you outside of combat. Multiple people start appearing for some reason in the arena to attack you. All kinds of stuff doesn't work, because this is not a fight to the death. This is just a fight to winning or losing. And so but there's no way, I can't pull my punches, right? There's right. No way for me to like choose to not kill people. And so like tungsten is just like fighting, you know, doing the game and like punching people and knocking them out, and sometimes those people just die.
Yeah.
There's nothing I can do about it.
It just happens.
So I go through this fight for probably, because of course it is extremely unbearably slow because it's a Fallout game.
Mm-hmm.
I go through this for about 20 minutes. And I have to restart like more than once because I accidentally kill somebody, or it just glitches. It just doesn't work. And there's like multiple people teleporting into the arena. And as they get more powerful, they do start hurting you. You know, so they're kicking me for 15 points of damage. I only got 100 hit points.
Yeah.
And so all this stuff is happening over and over again. And eventually I get to the last person. I punch them. And I'm mad at this point. Like I am.
You,
this
Cameron,
is probably,
are mad.
I am so angry. I'm like unbelievably angry. I've been playing this game for an hour and a half
mm-hmm.
at this point. And the only things I've done are navigate to Navarro, immediately have to leave, navigate to San Francisco, which is also very difficult, mm-hmm. and then just get caught up in this terrible glitch-filled garbage festival, right? It's just awful. I get to, it's either the last fight or the second to last fight. I knock the person down, and then the game crashed. And my brain exploded.
Mm-hmm.
Tonk went down into the core of his being. And I say Tonk because I don't mean Tonkston. I mean Tonk, mm-hmm. backward in time.
Yeah.
A full generation begins thinking about ways to prevent the future. He imagines, you know, remember when he transcended reality.
Mm-hmm.
He, in that moment, saw Tonkston's fate. And he knew that he could open up a ribonucleic force field that mm-hmm. would act as a teleporter to recreate his own life inside of the life of his progeny, his progeny's progeny.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this moment, Tonk became Tonk Reborn.
Mm-hmm.
Because he fully subsumed the life of Tonkston. And retroactively, Tonkston never existed to begin with.
Ooh.
Go back and look at the first episode of Too Much Future Season 2. It's just Tonk. There is no Tonkston. There is no Spoon.
Mm-hmm.
And so I used the character editor to give myself a bunch of hit points and, and give myself, because like, it's the exact same thing you're talking about, right? Like there, this is something I said before, and for whatever reason, people really do get kind of upset when we do these things or when I do these things. But here's the thing, right? There are two possible options here at the end of the game. One is I could just go out in the wilderness and kick and punch people for 4 or 5 hours and become very leveled up and then complete the game that way. Which is, by the way, the recommended way of completing the game. Just go level up now. They're basically, every guide you look at basically says, when you're at this point in the game, just go fight Enclave soldiers and kick them to death.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're supposed to do. That is like the antithesis of a good time. That's like the antithesis of thinking. That is the awful. It's bad. I hate it. So, got a bunch of hit points, got a bunch of action points, things like that, and just kicked the shit out of everybody, and defeated Lo Pan.
Well, congrats.
Thank
Welcome
you.
Back, Tonk.
Yeah. That's it's the sequel to Welcome Back, Cotter. Tonk Reborn is running around. So I did the Lo Pan and the Dragon Quest. I went into the Shi Temple, which has the Shi Emperor in it, or maybe it, I think it's called the Temple, right? The where the Shi live. I went in there and basically I talked to a guy who's like, listen, if you want to know where the people from your village are, I bet the Shi Emperor knows, but he's not going to talk to you
mm-hmm.
unless you give him some Vertibird plans. So maybe go do that. And I thought, okay. And so then I ran around this little area and I went into the science room where there was a computer, and the computer, basically I talked to the scientist and I said, hey, what's up with that computer? He says, listen, that's the computer that controls all of our technologies. Don't hack it. And I said, well, why can't I hack it? And he says, haha, don't do it or I'll kill you. And so then I turned around and immediately hacked it using my extremely high science skill that I had from before.
Mm-hmm.
And hacked it and just fiddling around with that, rerouted some fuel to a ship. It's called like the Valdez.
Mm-hmm. You just did this?
I just did this.
Just like, oh, this seems like something I should do.
Yeah, and so I had to go to the Valdez first. So initially when I did it, it was like reroute, and I said sure, and it wouldn't do it, and because it said no location. So I literally just ran out. Because I remember, I played the game before, right?
Mm-hmm.
I ran out, I went to the ship, the Valdez, which we'll talk about in just a second. I just went to it, went inside, left again, went back, and then rerouted the fuel. Without knowing why I would need to do that or how that works or anything like that.
It was flow.
And yeah, so I did that.
So at this point, have you not gone back to Navarro?
No. At this point, I have not gone back to Navarro.
Okay.
I believe right now, so I explore around the Valdez a little bit. It's a docked ship. It's a docked tanker ship.
Mm-hmm.
I explored around the Valdez a little bit, and then that's when I went to Navarro.
Oh, okay. So yeah, how did that work out for you? Did you do a like total murder fest there or
in Navarro? No, I actually so Navarro, I go back to Navarro. I go and stand behind Chris, initiate combat, murder him.
Mm-hmm.
Go into the little cabin that he told me not to go into, and go down into the secret passage that you took to mm-hmm. get to the base. Because what I'm after is what the Brotherhood of Steel sent me after, and also the She Emperor, which is Vertibird blueprints.
Mm-hmm.
I'm running around in here looking for Vertibird blueprints. The first person I say gets a little bark over their head, and they say, "Hey, you're out of uniform, officer." And so I run into the locker room, get a laser gun. I get an Enclave power armor, probably the same way you got it. And then I'm just able to run around doing whatever the hell I want to.
Now, this is interesting because you could do that mm-hmm. and I couldn't. Right? If they saw me, they immediately hostled.
Hmm.
The reason for this, and I looked this up to figure out, like when I, again, like I'm usually like consulting walkthroughs and things. Mm-hmm. The reason for this is that when you talk to the Brotherhood of Steel guy and he tells you about the Enclave, suddenly that trips a flag that makes it so that you can show up to Navarro and be like, "I'm here to join the Enclave." You can't, like... And so suddenly I think everyone in that area assumes that you're a new recruit, which is not what they do before you have that conversation.
Got it. Yeah, because I did have that conversation with the Brotherhood of Steel, and he says explicitly, "You could try to pretend to be a recruit." And I said, "That's a good idea." And he said, "You need to leave your party here, because obviously that's not going to work if you got a big crew running around with you." Mm-hmm. And so I did. I left Vic and Cassidy just hanging out outside the Brotherhood of Steel. So yeah, so I guess that worked.
Mm-hmm. Or actually, maybe it was because I brought my party down with me.
You're telling me you had a full size death claw just running around?
Oh, I mean, he's wearing a robe. You don't know he's a death claw. You just think he's a guy in a robe.
So that could be it too. Yeah. But in any case, yeah. So I was able to walk around and talk to people. So you didn't get to talk to Dr. Schraber.
I killed Dr. Schraber. He was the one who I got my RoboCop dog from.
Yes. So he is objectively evil. He is also a reference, right?
This yes, has he be is. A yes, yes.
Do you want to explain who Dr. Schraber is?
Dr. Schraber is, well, you can tell, is there more about his conversation that builds into this reference? Or
No, okay. There's nothing. Okay. I think it's just like mad scientist kind of things. Yeah.
So, Dr. Schraber is a reference to... Is it Freud? Does Freud?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Freud initially, yes. He's one of like the case studies for psychoanalysis.
Right. He is a judge in Vienna
mm-hmm.
that Sigmund Freud writes about, who is kind of Schraber, that is sort of one of the first big case studies in what we now call schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He has this like he has this sort of like delusion that the world is being controlled by a kind of like loom in the sky, various bizarre things.
Mm-hmm. He believed that the sun was shining out of his butthole.
Yes, right. Yes, quite literally. Like that is one of the things that he believes. Mm-hmm. Judge Schraber becomes a. I don't know, sort of like weird thing to refer. He gets referenced in Dark City, actually. Mm-hmm. If you've seen the film Dark City, Kiefer Sutherland's character is named Schraber, and he is like specifically named after this same person.
And I wonder, that's kind of what I wonder too, is I wonder, is this a Dark City reference? Because this and Dark City come out right around the same time. So is this a Dark City reference, or is this a Judge Schraber reference?
Right. Well, I feel like it's...
But he is like very much this like in the same way that the Kiefer Sutherland character is referencing this kind of like, you know, in one's own world of reference kind of thing. It's a similar kind of vibe for this Dr. Schraber
mm-hmm.
About it. The reason Dr. Schraber matters or the reason that like he's such an interesting historical figure is that he wrote extensively about his own experience.
Yes.
So it's not as if, like, what we have is just, like, a record of people interviewing him or whatever. He has extensive journals. I took a class in graduate school where we just read through Schreiber's journals.
Right.
And they're fascinating. I mean, he was able to make a very strong case for the things that he believed was happening in the world.
Right. Things like, here is how God is talking to me.
Yeah. And he just had, like, a very strong logical way for it to work. Kind of famously, Deleuze and Guattari in their, in their takedown of Lacan and their kind of resuscitation of Freud, they say, well, what if the sun was shining out of his anus?
Yeah.
Like, what do you do then? Like, what if that was true? it's a long digression about Schreiber, but Schreiber is the person, we learn that he is the person who, made the death clause intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
He invented K-9, this robot, mm-hmm. robot dog, who I did not talk to because I was not going to have any of that. I'm just not interested.
In dogs and robot dogs?
In robot dogs. I just knew where it was going to go.
Okay. Right?
I know what the fallout ceiling is for the robot dog. And so I just ignored it. And so I did that. He gave me a quest. There's a death claw. A talking death claw who is trapped in this place.
Mm.
And Schreiber told me, he was like, hey, I hate that death claw. I can't believe we invented it. And I was like, well, why did you invent a talking death claw? And he tells me the same stuff that you learned a couple episodes ago. And I said, all right, well, let me just take care of that for you. And he said, really? I said, yeah, sure. And I went and closed the door and then I killed him. Not the death claw. I killed Dr. Schreiber and I took a key card off his body. And then I went and opened the door and I let the death claw out. He left.
Bye.
He went and lived his life, and then I ran around the base because you're at an underground floor here. I went up to the ground level, and you find out where the vertebrate plans are. You can talk to a couple of different people and figure that out. I went to the mechanic. There's a mechanic standing in front of a lockbox. But you can't open the lockbox because he gets mad. So I pickpocketed him and put plastic explosives in his pocket and then ran away and he exploded spontaneously. No one knows how that happened. And then I went and got the vertebrate plans and then I left. That's it.
Excellent.
Yeah. Now you might notice, Michael, what have I left in Navarro?
You have left a critical item that will be necessary for getting to the very end of the game.
Mm-hmm. So later I had to come back just to get that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
You have no reason to think that it would be here at this point, right? You unless you're just a person who's looting everything and taking everything you see, there is a good chance that you will have to come back here.
Yeah, and even weirder, I only found out about it because once you find out you need these items, and we'll talk in just a second about that, but once you find out you need these items, you can have a conversation with, like, the medic in town, and you can just say, like, hey doc, where do you think I can find this little doohickey? What's it that I need to finish the game? And he'll be like, oh, I think you can probably go to the military base at Navarro, the secret military base at Navarro. I bet they definitely have that. And you can say, oh, what about this other doohickey? And he'll be like, oh, I think you can go to this other place. So there's literally a character who should have no knowledge of any of this who just tells you where to go.
Because the character who does tell you about these things, for some reason, only says, like, oh, that should be in an old military base, or that should be in an old vault. And that's it. Mm-hmm. That's all the hint you get from the actual quest-giving NPC.
So I come back, I give my the vertebrate plans to the Brotherhood of Steel. I've already done the thing I needed to do for the Xi Emperor, I think, so I'm just sitting. Brotherhood of Steel gives you a copy of these blueprints.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sitting on those. Still got those in my inventory. But what did you do with the tanker ship?
Well, so I came back. Well, I didn't come back, right? I showed up in San Francisco burning with incandescent rage, right? Just imagine Eleanor, like, walking through San Francisco, just, like, radiating, like, heat and light. She gives the vertebrate blueprints to the Brotherhood of Steel. They're happy, gets the copy, goes and gives it to the Xi. And they're thrilled by that. So then they let me go talk to the Emperor. Did you ever talk to the Emperor at any point?
No. Nope, never went back.
Take a big guess about the big secret about the Emperor.
The big is it deeply offensive?
It could be. It depends on how you try to interpret this, I think. But just like...
Is it Rodney Dangerfield?
Yes!
Oh, wow.
Turns out the Shi Emperor is just Rodney Dangerfield's. He survived this whole time.
But he's finally getting some respect.
Yep. No, the Shi Emperor is a computer.
Oh.
It's a computer. It's actually specifically the computer mainframe from the nuclear sub that they pulled mm-hmm. out of the sub and, like, have built their entire society around, because I guess, like, the computer that runs the nuclear submarine continues to be useful when pulled out of a submarine.
Of course.
One thing that's interesting, just to pause here, is to note how this will come back in Fallout 3, which we will talk about at that point. But so it turns out that the Shi Emperor is just the Emperor is the name of the computer system. And even though they have built a throne room for it, there is just a room behind the throne room where there's a computer and you can talk, like you can look stuff up. So you look up where the... You can ask the computer where the people from Arroyo are, and it's like, oh, they're probably on the Enclave base on this particular oil derrick right off at sea, this oil rig off at sea. And also you can look up various other things. It's like running the numbers on your chance of success. Like it's like an option called forecast, and when you click on it, it's like, chosen one's quest, chance of success, 15%. Other things that you can learn by talking with the Emperor. The Shi are doing all sorts of experiments in terms of like physics and chemistry and biology. They're developing new technologies. One of the things that the advisor to the Emperor, who's this guy named Ken Lee, he tells you that the Shi are looking toward the future. And this is a very, like, 1990s, like, late 80s way of thinking about, like, East Asian, countries and people, right? The idea that they're the ones who are planning for the future while American industry is falling behind. Mm-hmm. So you get all this information about all of these wonderful, cool technologies that they're developing, one of which happens to be the Wanamingos.
Oh, really?
Yep. You find out that their biology, or their like geneticists, hybridized the alien creatures that we fought in Redding. Somehow they ended up there, and you can find like in their records, like one of them goes missing. It's assumed that the Hubologists have taken it. The Hubologists, we've mentioned before, are this completely out of left field parody of Scientology. And
I never found the Hubologists. I don't even know where they are. I looked around.
Well, they're here, and I actually just realized I told this in the wrong order. So the first thing I did is I gave the vertebrate plans to the Shi, and then Ken Lee was like, that's great, thank you. We need you to do one more thing for us. We need you to take care of the Hubologists, who are basically posing a threat to Shi power in San Francisco by... being a religion that is convincing people to join it, which is not like the most persuasive way of framing this, but you know, the Hubologists do kind of suck. So they live off in sort of the northeast corner of the map on, the direction is toward the Golden Gate Bridge. And they are working on a plan to fill a pre-war rocket with fuel so they can like blast off into space. And the Shi tell you like basically like go assassinate the AHS-9, which is the name of their leader. And AHS stands for Aligned Hub Seeker. So Aligned Hub Seeker 9. You go to the Hubologists. You're like, hey, Hubologists, I'm interested in joining your organization. And they're like, sure, come into our little Hubologist bunker. And you go, like, Helenor goes down there, talks with some people. They send you off to, like, a little, like, meeting where there are, like, quote-unquote celebrities who are just these two people who got really famous in New Reno. and they will tell you, like, you know, here's all the great things that'll happen when you become a Hubologist. It's very clearly, right, just straight up, it's a Scientology parody. If you continue walking past that room, you go into the room where their leader is, Helenor kills him, and then kills all of the Hubologist guards and leaves. When this happens, the people in Chinatown love you. Like, all of their barks turn green, and they all start shouting about how... they're like, oh, you're that person who killed AHS-9. That's great.
Dang.
Yeah. So the Xi and the Hubologists are very opposed, even though there's not a strong sense of that prior to this. And anyway, then I go back and I talk to Kinley, and he lets me talk to the Emperor, who tells me about the oil rig, and then I go and I check out the Valdez, the tanker that is... docked offshore, and I learn about a whole bunch of things, I guess. You've talked about the tanker a little bit, but how do you want to go about this, I guess?
About just talking about the tanker?
Yeah, because you've already kind of established some things, I think. Like, you already rerouted the fuel. So what?
Yeah.
And you don't even know that the tanker needs fuel yet.
I never found out the tanker needs fuel.
I was going to say, finding out that the tanker needs fuel is its, like, entire other thing.
Yeah. No. So here's how I completed the tanker. This is truly bizarre. I went into the tanker. I talked to the guy in the bar. I don't think I have his name written down. I don't. Talked to a guy in the bar, and he just kind of laid out, like, hey, you know, you should go talk to the captain upstairs to figure out, like, what we need to get this all hunk junk going again. Because, like I don't know why I would need to do that. I have not found out that the Enclave have, like, an additional base somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, all right, that just sounds cool. I go upstairs. I try to talk to the captain. The captain says, you're going to have to, I don't talk to just anybody. It's like, even it's just a bark above his head.
Mm-hmm.
I don't talk to just anybody. I need you to do something for my friends. So I walk around and I can't find any of his friends. Like, I don't know what that means. Because there's no one else in the room with him. There's a computer, though, and I just go use the computer and use my hacking skills. And it says you need a nav computer, you need fuel. And something else. Oh, no. There's just a message about the mooring, like the docking mooring things or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have to do anything about that. So after I did that, that's when I ended up talking to the doctor. So just unrelated to that.
Mm-hmm.
I was just running around. I ended up talking to the doctor because one of my arms was, like, broken. And so I was trying to find somewhere to heal that. I ended up talking to the doctor. And the doctor is like, it just gives me the options to ask about, like, where can I find these things that I need for the quest? And he's like, well, one's probably in a vault and one is in Navarro. And so I went and got the fob from Navarro and I went to Vault 13, which we can talk about in just a minute. And I found the other thing, like the nav chip.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came back and I put them in the computer.
Wow.
I couldn't figure out what that part was. I actually had to look that up because I still cannot talk to the captain to get the quest. And so I actually had to pull up a thing. I like, it wouldn't let me put it in the computer. And so I, like, looked up. I was just like, nav chip. And it was like, oh, you got to go down into the bowels of the ship. And then you got to insert it there. And so you go down one level and it's, like, full of Wanamingos and shit and other mutated things. And it's very clear where you're supposed to go use the items. And so I just went and did that. And then, after doing all that, I just completed this section of the game kind of on accident. So I did not have the quest the entire time. What happens at the end of this section was very strange because I did not know that's what was happening. What I've just described is the entire trajectory at the end of the game for me, which was just like running around and collecting items because the game was telling me to do that, but not in a way that seemed rational to me. But mm-hmm. I was like beyond rationality at that point.
Yeah. No, it is definitely beyond rationality. So this tanker, the Valdez, it's an old Poseidon oil tanker, right? Poseidon Oil is this pre-war company, and it's the same company that apparently started that gas station that Navarro, the Navarro base is operating behind. This tanker has been, so when you think of San Francisco, in addition to, you know, the sort of history of Chinese and generally East Asian immigration and sort of that labor explosion and all that stuff we've already talked about. We also think of San Francisco as being a, you know, hippy dippy, sort of artistic location, right, and community. This is before tech really, really cements itself in our imaginations. So where did all of the hippies of San Francisco go? Because in true Fallout terms, right, there's this weird thing that happens where the apocalypse happens, but none of the stereotypes change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All of the crust punks basically moved onto this oil tanker.
Yes.
And the thing that is interesting to me about this is that we already had a group of sort of enlightened artsy punks in the first game. They were called the Followers of the Apocalypse. Mm-hmm. And they just, like, it seems like they were supposed to be on this tanker to me, right? If I think about this through, like, my narrative designer brain, it would make sense to bring that faction back here. For some reason, they don't. It just happens to be another, like, an entirely different group of crust punks who have taken up residence here searching for, like, trying to build a better community, right, free from greed or whatever. And what they wanted to do was take over this tanker and then, like, set sail. And I learned all this from the captain eventually, because I did find out how to talk to him.
Punks never change.
Yeah.
Punks. Punks never changes.
So here's how you get the captain to talk to you. Okay. There is a guy hanging out near the bar, I think, who, when you talk to him, is talking about how bad he feels because he was gambling with one of the merchants whose name I don't have written down. I think it's Lao Chu. One of the merchants in Chinatown, he was gambling the other night and he bet his pancreas and then lost. So he is missing his pancreas. And he's very upset because of this. So you can go talk to Lao Chu. Here is my feeling, right? Again, this is Eleanor burning with incandescent rage, right? I've said before that Eleanor has tried to be, like, a good person, and we are now beyond good and evil, right? Like, that is just clearly the world of the Wasteland does not sustain what Eleanor thinks is the moral vision of the universe, and so she is just, like, beyond it all. So she's burning with rage. She walks up, finds out this guy has lost his pancreas, and it's like, well, this is one of the punk captain's friends. So I go talk to the merchant, and the merchant is like, ah, yeah, no, he did bet his pancreas, and I removed it from him, and then I gave it away. Well, where did he give it away to?
Mm-hmm.
He gave it to Ken Lee, the advisor of the Xi Emperor.
So Damn I have Ken.
And so I have to go talk to him. And this is what I mean when I say, like, this game gets so frustrating at the end, because it's just, I talk to a guy, he sends me to talk to another guy, and then that guy sends me to talk to another guy. All in different maps that are all adjacent, but I am just walking from one place to another that I have already been. It feels like such a structured delay for no reason. I go and talk to Ken Lee, and I'm like, hey man, I heard you got a pancreas. And he's like, yes, I am going to eat it with some fava beans and a nice Chianti. And yeah, like, because of course, like, Silence of the Lambs reference. And then you can tell him that it is a human pancreas, which apparently he didn't know, despite having made the cannibal joke. And then he is like, oh crap, this is a human pancreas? Well, you can have it then. So he gives it back to you. Then you have to go back to the guy. I can't even remember his name, right? The guy whose pancreas it is, and say, hey, I have your pancreas. And he's like, well, that's great. Now find me a doctor to put it back in. So then you have to go back into Chinatown and go to the doctor whom you have already met. His name is Dr. Fung. And I got to talk to him about Doc Holliday, who I think was in Reading. Maybe he was in Vault City.
I've wrote it down, I think. No, I think in Reading.
Yeah. Anyway, he's the doctor that you meet in Reading, and he had mentioned Dr. Fung to you before. So when you meet Dr. Fung here, you can bring up Doc Holliday, and he's like, oh, yeah, how's he doing? And you can sort of give him an update, and this, you know, makes Dr. Fung like you. And so he will then replace this guy's pancreas for free. So presumably, if you did not bring up Doc Holliday, then this guy would charge you for fixing this other guy.
Hmm. It's funny, I got to have that conversation, but obviously not in this context. And so I was just like, hey, do you remember Doc Holliday? And he's like, yeah, I do. What's he up to? And I was like, he's living his life somewhere. And he goes, oh, that's good. That's it. That's like the whole conversation.
So then I have to wait like 2 in-game days while this guy gets his pancreas replaced.
Oh, great.
Mm-hmm. Because you have to wait for him to walk out of the room where he spawns, disappear, and then appear and walk back to his normal place. At which point, finally, the captain of this ship will talk to you. And he will tell you what we already know, which is that we need fuel. We need FOB thing that gets us into the computer room, and we need some sort of navigation chip. And the captain, you learn a couple of things from him. One is that he used to be Enclave.
Dang.
He became a crust punk after leaving the Enclave. Once he realized, and you can get a little more backstory here, he says, you know, they were, he, when he was recruited to the Enclave, was told that he was like fighting for America or like sort of the old world. And then he found out, as he puts it, something like, it turned out I was only fighting for the rich fat cats who were trying to keep their like control of society or something like that. So we get just this barest hint of like what the Enclave was and where it came from, that it was a sort of, you know, concerted effort by certain elements of the upper class pre-war to maintain power and eventually come back out and reconquer America. This disillusioned the captain. Now I have to find all of these parts and figure out how to get fuel. Well, Helenor, despite all of her many, many charms now, all of her many superpowers, is still not a great hacker. So I have to use one of the hackers on the ship to help me. There's a guy named Badger. Did you talk to him?
No.
So there's
could not find, like, I tried to look for many of these people and just couldn't find them.
Yeah, because again, this game has these huge maps that are filled with NPCs, and maybe 2 of them are people that are important, but none of them are visually distinct from each other.
Yep.
So I find Badger. He's like their resident computer hacker in a very like 90s crust punk kind of way. He's constantly farting and burping. And
great. Yep. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you can talk to him. And he'll talk to you about how he can hack the Xi systems to divert their fuel from whatever they're doing with it into the tanker. And I'm like, great, like, what'll I need to do for that to happen? He's like, well, you got to find my girlfriend. My girlfriend went down below deck and she's like disappeared. Please go find her. So I go down below deck, which, as you've already said, is filled with all these monsters, just for some reason, right? All these crust punks living literally up one stairway away from some of the most powerful creatures in this world that will just murder you. There are tons of Wanamingos down here. Helenor goes through, destroys them all, of course, rolling crits every single which way. She has a little Gauss pistol now, which is she got this off of someone in Navarro. It's the most powerful small gun in the game. She's just ruining everything. Finds the girlfriend, frees her. She goes back upstairs. You have to wait for her to walk back upstairs, at which point Badger will be like, great, my girlfriend's back. Now I will hack the fuel lines for the Xi for you. That happens. I've already gotten the fob from Navarro. Then I have to walk all the way back to Vault 13 to get this friggin' nav chip. Right, Vault 13, which I have been to. I already cleared that out. I got a party member there. But it turns out there is this one unique item. It is the only place that appears in the game, and you have to go all the way back there to get it up, to like pick it up.
I actually sent you a Discord message about this. I just couldn't get it's in a locked cabinet. I couldn't get the cabinet open. Like, it was wild. I just could not do it. I just had to, like, save and reload my game a bunch of times and keep trying to lockpick it. I have no idea what was up. I had a crowbar, which opens every other locker in the game, but would not open that locker.
Bizarre.
It is bizarre. But what was even more bizarre was going to Vault 13 and seeing all the Death Claws are dead.
Oh, that's right, because you've waited so long.
Do they get murdered if
you
wait too long?
The Enclave goes through and exterminates the Death Claws if a certain number of days pass in-game.
Oh, no. So at the beginning of this episode, when I said, like, things to make you think the Enclave are super bad, that's one of them. I thought that just happened at this point in the game. I didn't realize this was a time thing. I mean, it still sucks. And still,
I mean,
like,
maybe it might. It might be like it happens automatically. It might be kind of like Arroyo, where it'll happen eventually on a timer, but it'll also be tripped automatically if you reach a certain point. But yeah.
Yeah. In any case, I think... like, no matter when it happens or under what context it happens, the point of the event of murdering all the talking Death Claws is just to say the Enclave are bad, right? So when you get there, you can watch some security footage of what occurred, and it gives you a little scripted event. And it's basically just the hugest Enclave soldier that we've seen a couple times already. We saw them kill like the farmers in the desert that time. I've been attacked by him one time, I think, for some reason. Hmm. I just had to die. It was like one of my many reloads. But he's just showing up, and he's like, all the Death Claws are dead except for one. He's like, you are the last one. You are dead. And I kill you now. And then he exploded the Death Claw. And I thought that was terrible. All the eggs are destroyed, of course. The Death Claw queen is dead.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, oh, these are legitimately some of the coolest things in Fallout, in all of Fallout, and the absolute horizon line of thinking how you could, you know, interact with those is, well, they gotta be killed by somebody. I just don't find that very interesting, but came in here got the nav chip and then went back. Is there anything that happened here for you that was interesting?
No, I'm wondering, it's sounding like, so one of the things I have been wondering is, like, why on earth do they make you go back to Vault 13? Because there's just, like, no way, unless you happen to rob everyone and pick up the nav chip then, what is the point of making you go back to Vault 13? And I'm thinking maybe it is specifically to see the Death Claws get massacred, and maybe I somehow messed up the scripting in my game where it didn't trigger for me. With my character editor or something. I don't know. Because that seems... This was like the confusion that I had. It's like, why on earth are they sending me back here?
Yeah.
And I don't know.
I don't know.
But yeah, no, that was it. And then I came back. So let's see. I had everything. Then I go back. I put everything into the computer. And yes, then I set sail. We're out of here.
Yeah. So I slammed it on the computer. The captain still won't talk to me. And there's a command you get, and it's just go.
Yeah.
It just says the word go. And I was like, I didn't know what that meant. I thought maybe go was like, we're good to go. And not now like begin the end game of the game. And so I hit go, and then like immediately, yeah, you get a cutscene. And like, I'm not one to judge, you know, what people make cutscenes and what they don't make cutscenes. Like, you know, you video game developers, you can do whatever you want. But I will say that this cutscene of the Valdez leaving the port and then eventually, you know, smashing into or landing in the oil derrick that you get to, this Enclave space, one of the most boring things I've seen in the Fallout game, and I can think of 10,000 things I would rather see a cutscene of
it is
rather than this.
It is really something, isn't it? Like, just the... So I know that these little cinematics, they take time, they take resources. Like, that's why there are so few of them. That's why they only happen at these big moments. But I do not care about this boat for the amount of time that I watch the various parts of this boat come online.
Yeah, there's so many. It's like you see all the moorings snap, and then you see like a little like raggedy doll like slowly fall off a thing, and you see it sail in away, you know,
out of the shot. You see the stars moving over the bow at night.
And then you see it sailing into the shot. Like, it's basically, they were like, we got to make a full movie of what happened. I can, like, connect up the dots here. I would have much rather had, like, when you open up Vault 13 and, like, it slowly goes over. And what's inside, not people, but death claws. Like, imagine that as a cutscene.
Mm-hmm.
Or when you get to, think about this. When you get back to your own village, you don't see, you were just met with, like, Hakunin talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see any kind of contextualization of that. What about vertebrates flying overhead?
Right. Like, what if, as you were approaching, right, you saw the vertebrate, like, it goes into a cutscene and you see the vertebrates going overhead, and then you go forward and you see, like, Arroyo in flames or something.
Yeah, exactly. I can just think of so many more, like, story important things that we have seen that would be a lot more interesting looking. Maybe that was in the plan, right? We've talked several times about how quickly this game is developed, but anyway. It is not an exciting thing, but then you end up kind of standing on a platform, and that is where I save the game.
Yep.
I think we've made ourselves pretty well known about what we are, what we thought about this little content that we played here. Next episode, we're finishing the game.
Yep. Finally.
So we'll be finishing the game, then we'll take a break for a while, and then we'll start again with season 3 of playing Fallout 3, which will be quite interesting.
Are we going to do the Bible? Are we going to do the Bible?
Yes, we are. Okay. Yeah, so I think just to give people a schematic of what we're going to be doing, we're going to be final episode. There will be the Fallout Bible episode, and then there'll be a break, and then there will be Fallout 3. So yeah, we're definitely going to read the Fallout Bible. I am like actually excited to do that because I'm very interested in what we could find, what additional information we have. If you've enjoyed listening to this episode, smash the subscribe button if you haven't done that already, and hit the like button. If you want to know every video we do, hit the bell button. That'll be helpful for us. It's helpful for you. Ring-a-ding that bell. As the Green Brothers, as they say, ring-a-ding that bell in the doobly-doo or whatever the hell. Michael, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at WarrenIsDead.
You can go to twitter.com/RangeTouch to figure out all about Range Touch stuff. And if you really enjoy the show, you can go to patreon.com/RangeTouch. Both of those links are in the description down below. If you want this as a podcast feed, not to watch it on YouTube, you can go support the Patreon at $3 a month. We are currently doing kind of not a donation drive, but like a patrons drive.
Mm-hmm.
At $1,200 a month, we will start a new Stephen King podcast where we read every Stephen King work in publication order. If you are interested in hearing Michael and I do that, and frankly, right, just to give an idea about that, we've been training for this our entire lives.
Mm-hmm. Like, Cameron and I have had extensive off-podcast conversations about the works of Stephen King, so...
Yes, yeah. Extensive. I have read, I want to say, 90% of Stephen King's novels.
I was going to say, I have read... I have read every novel Stephen King published up through Duma Key in, like, 2008.
I similar, and then I'm real spotty after that, but I have read some after that. I've got the Institute, one of his more recent novels. I got that in the other room.
Mm-hmm.
Getting ready to do that. So we are prepared to do mm-hmm. that. So here's a little plug at the end. We're currently at about $900 and something. So we're not that far away. So if you want to get access to this show in podcast form, real convenient for you, it's $3 a month. That's a very simple thing. It's less than a cup of coffee. So think about that. That's just a plug here at the end. So we'll be back in 2 weeks with the episode on the end of the game, and we'll find out what the heck the Enclave's all about.
Until next time, war never changes, but Fallout really, really should at this point.